Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello again, Dan Rodericks here from the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 422, part two of a film critic's favorite films. Today we hear about some of Linda DeLibero's favorites. Linda teaches and runs the film program at Johns Hopkins University, and monthly she joins critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed and me to talk about either classic films or the current cinema. In episode 421, we heard Chris talk about 10 of his favorites. Today we'll go through some of Linda's, and an interesting list she has. I guarantee you'll learn a lot about these pictures, and you want to take some notes for movies you might have missed. On Linda's list, three Westerns, one Hitchcock, one Kubrick, one film directed by Orson Welles and starring his voice, a John Wayne film that many consider his best, one from the 1970s starring Gene Hackman, a film directed by Terrence Malick, and one directed by Kenneth Lonergan, not Manchester by the Sea, and one film directed by someone you probably never heard of.
I started with Orson Welles. I really kind of drew my picks from directors that I love. I kind of did it spur of the moment, off the cuff, first thing that popped into my head. And, I thought of Orson Welles, all of whose films have greatness in them. But I picked The Magnificent Ambersons, which was made in 1942 and was very famously butchered by RKO. This was his follow-up to Citizen Kane, and he thought of it as his masterpiece, his greatest film, greater than Citizen Kane. But he left before Final Cut. Welles went to Brazil. Meanwhile, his rough cut, which was 132 minutes long, was previewed with a Dorothy L'Amour movie, a musical. So people coming to see this lighthearted musical were also confronted with this very dark, somber film about the demise of this aristocratic Midwestern family and the rise of industry and the automobile. It's a very dark film, as you can imagine, with Orson Welles. And they got the most brutal comments that you can imagine. You know, it was boring, it was stupid, they laughed in all the wrong places. So RKO said, we got to do something about this. They cut it down to 88 minutes. They cut off Welles's ending, which he claimed was the greatest scene that he had shot. And they filmed a new ending, which is patently absurd. It's a ridiculous happy ending, and basically semi-ruined the film. Now, that original cut has become legendary. People keep thinking that somehow it's going to turn up, but it's gone. Despite the fact that it was reduced down and much of the greatness of it was taken out, there still is a lot of greatness. It's a really worthwhile film to see. It stars the great Joseph Cotten and Tim Holt, who was usually in cowboy movies. And he resurrected Dolores Costello, who was a great silent film star, married to John Barrymore at one point. So it's a film that is really about the change that overcomes America, small town America, at the turn of the century and beyond. And also about this family that loses its fortune and the tragedy of growing old, of being penniless, of having to face a grim, uncertain future. And in this clip I chose, you will hear Orson Welles' voiceover, which continues on and off throughout the film. It's toward the end of the movie. It's a very grim scene. George Amberson Minifer, who was played by Tim Holt, was this young, spoiled scion of this family who everybody in the beginning wants to see him get his comeuppance, and they just hope they're around when he gets it. And so that's kind of a continuing theme throughout the film. Of course, because of the choices he's made and because of his arrogance, he has lost everything. And this recites that last walk toward the Amberson mansion as they've lost it and as he is about to struggle to find a way to survive.
George Amberson Minifer walked homeward slowly through what seemed to be the strange streets of a strange city. For the town was growing and changing. It was heaving up in the middle incredibly. It was spreading incredibly. And as it heaved and spread, it befouled itself and darkened its sky. This was the last walk home he was ever to take up National Avenue to Amberson Addition, from the big old house at the foot of Amberson Boulevard. Tomorrow they were to move out. Tomorrow everything would be gone. God forgive me. Something had happened. A thing which, years ago, had been the eagerest hope of many, many good citizens of the town. And now it came at last. George Amberson Minifer had got his comeuppance. He got it three times filled and running over. But those who had so longed for it were not there to see it. They never knew it. Those who were still living had forgotten all about it and all about him.
And it sort of stands as a testament, I think, to Wells's greatness, that even when something like this happened, there is still so much to love and admire in this film. I thought about Hitchcock, who is one of my favorite directors. And again, I had to choose from many, many favorites. But I think I chose Shadow of a Doubt because, A, it's one of those films of his that some people may not know very much about. And it was his favorite film. It was considered his first truly American movie. It was released in 1943. It also stars Joseph Cotten, and it has some elements in it that are very reminiscent of The Magnificent Ambersons. This is a movie about malevolence in very charming form. Joseph Cotten is Uncle Charlie. He is a serial murderer. He kills wealthy widows. He takes the money, and he lives well, but it's not really about the money. He has a kind of arrogance about him. He believes he's ridding the world of useless women. He's deeply misogynistic, obviously. And he comes into this small town where his sister and her family live. It's Santa Rosa, California at the time, really Main Street America. And he has a special bond with his niece, young Charlie, who's been named after him. And she worships her uncle, but gradually comes to see and realize that he is the serial murderer. And it's a film that is not only about the depredations of this seriously flawed worldview that he has, but it's also about the coming of age of this young woman played by Teresa Wright in an absolutely brilliant performance, and her loss of innocence as she confronts this evil and has to conquer it. And it's one of those films where when people accuse Hitchcock of misogyny, I always point this out. This is really a film that acknowledges that a smart, resourceful, brilliant young woman has so few choices, and there's such tragedy in that. And that's why I find this film incredibly touching. And this little clip here is Uncle Charlie basically rehearsing at the dinner table his philosophy about the fat, greedy women that, as we subsequently learn, he kills one after the other.
Husbands who've spent their lives making fortunes, working and working. And then they die and leave their money to their wives, their silly wives. And what do the wives do, these useless women? You see them in the hotels, the best hotels, every day by the thousands, drinking the money, eating the money, losing the money at bridge, playing all day and all night, smelling of money, proud of their jewelry, but of nothing else. Horrible. Faded, fat, greedy women.
But they're alive. They're human beings.
Are they?
From the thrilling pages of life rides a man you must fear and respect. A man whose unconquerable will and boundless determination carved a lusty, rough, and boisterous slice of history called The Searchers. It's John Wayne as Ethan Edwards, who had a rare kind of courage. The courage that simply keeps on and on, far beyond all reasonable endurance, never thinking of himself as martyred, never thinking of himself as brave.
So we'll find him in the end, I promise you.
The Searchers is on a lot of cinephiles' top 10 list. It is a legendary Western by the great director of Westerns, John Ford. I love it for many reasons. I'm a great fan of Westerns for many reasons. There are three of them on my list. I didn't even realize it until I looked afterwards that I had picked three. This film is partly great because it is about racism. The racist in question is played by John Wayne in, I think, his most powerful performance on screen. He is a man who wanders the earth. He had fought in the Civil War on the southern side. He has a shady past. One of the things I think is so remarkable about this film is that through his character, we get an excellent delineation of the notion of projection as a part of the racist mentality. In other words, this is a man who is an outcast, who has illicit longings for his brother's wife. He's not a good man. He is also somebody who's very attuned to the natural world and knows the Native American way very well. And yet he hates the Native American, called Indians, of course, back then. He burns with a kind of irrational hatred for them. And in part, it's because they seem to represent to him, perhaps he doesn't realize it, everything that he hates about himself. They have, in a really horrific raid on his brother's house, they've killed his brother, his brother's wife, and their children, all except their daughter, Debbie, who's a little girl at the time. They kidnap her, and she grows up among this tribe. And he spends the whole movie searching for her, along with his nephew, Martin Pauley, played by Jeffrey Hunter. The purpose for him, for Ethan Edwards, is to kill Debbie because she has been defiled by living among the natives. Martin wants to rescue her because she's his cousin and he loves her and has no such prejudices. So it's pretty remarkable. Many people have said that this film is in many ways a sly commentary on Brown versus Board of Education and the racial episodes that were concurrent with its release. And I think that's pretty true. You don't really see a character like Ethan Edwards. He is in some ways heroic, and yet it's very, very hard to like this person because he has some deeply disturbing feelings that were very much on display in the film. This is a passage where toward the end of the film, they're about to rescue Debbie, and Ethan has taken the opportunity to write his will And he's left everything to Martin, which surprises Martin because he doesn't really, Ethan doesn't really like Martin that much because he too has a Native American blood. But he's bequeathed everything to him. As Martin is reading the will, once again, Ethan makes it clear that he intends to kill Debbie and basically says she's not human because she's a squaw.
Well, looks as though I'm going to have to open that shoulder again, get the poison out. Sure beats me, Ethan, how you could have stayed alive this long.
I want you to read this.
I, Ethan Edwards, being of a sound mind and without any blood kin, do hereby
bequeath means leave.
Bequeath all my property of any kind to Martin Pauley. What do you mean you don't have any blood kin? Well, Debbie's your blood kin.
Not no more, she ain't.
Well, you can keep your will. I don't want any of your property. Besides, I ain't forgetting you was getting all set to shoot her yourself. What kind of a man are you anyway?
She's been living with a buck. She's not the
buck. Shut your dirty mouth! I hope you die.
That'll be the
westerns
day.
That I choose, that I'm most fond of, are the ones that are revisionist. Even The Searchers, way back in 1954, was beginning to address the issues of the frontier and what it actually meant to conquer nature, to conquer the world, and to basically wipe out an entire race of people. Also, the mythic quality of the Western, to try to dismantle that. I think the greatest Westerns are highly aware of that myth and are coming to grips with it. And that's certainly true of The Wild Bunch. It's one of the great revisionist Westerns. It also introduces a kind of pathological violence into cinema that had heretofore been unknown.
If they move, kill them.
Most people who criticize the movie critique that violence, which still today looks pretty bad. Peckinpah's aim was to deprettify the Western. When people get shot, this is what happens. It's not the way you think it is. And you're going to have to wallow in it so that you can come to grips with how horrifying it is. And I hope it makes you sick. That was basically his point. Of course, you could argue that the opposite kind of happened. A lot of people thought that it glamorized violence. But I think the more important thing is we have these characters in this film who have come to the end of their ropes. This is a kind of version of the real hole-in-the-wall gang that we see in Butch Cassidy. This is not Butch Cassidy's world. These guys have had it. One of the things I love most about the film is the casting of William Holden, the great matinee idol of the 50s, now an elderly, broken-down man, and the wonderful Ben Johnson and Warren Oates, who play the Gorch brothers, part of the gang, Ernest Borgnine in his greatest role, and Robert Ryan as William Holden's old partner, who is now on the side of the law. The film is an exploration of the end of the West. You know, he's trying to strip away the myth of the noble cowboy. These guys are not noble. Holden's character tries to get them to hold to a code, but it really is kind of pointless and meaningless. It's a very anarchic, nihilistic film, but it's also, I think, one of the greatest films ever made. This clip is near the beginning. They've just pulled off what they think is a great bank robbery, although they've lost some men and it was very bloody. And they get to their, you know, place where they're going to hide out, and they encounter Freddie Sykes, who's played by Edmund O'Brien, another great role, who is going to join their gang. And they open the bags of gold, and they find out that they've been had by the bank. They're washers.
Silver rings.
Silver rings, your butt. Them's washers. Damn! Washers. Washers. We shot our way out of that town for a dollar's worth of steel hulls.
They set it up.
They? Who in the hell is they?
And so it's all been foiled. And they're very bitter about this. Freddie Sykes says, it's this wonderful speech. There's something very Shakespearean about this whole episode to me. Who is they? Who did this to us? And he gives this speech about who they is. And of course, it takes on a larger meaning about they. And I was reminded of Butch Cassidy because there's a recurring line there. Who are these guys? And these guys, of course, are the powers that be. Today we would say, hey, they're threatening to take away our health care. They? Who is they? We all know who they is, and Freddie Sykes is going to tell us the truth.
Who in the hell is they? They? Why, they is just plain and fancy they. That's who they is. Caught you, didn't they, huh? Tied a tin can to your tail, led you in and waltzed you out again. Oh, my, what a bunch. Big tough one, eh? Here you are with a handful of holes, a thumb up your ass, and a big grin to pass the time of day with. They! Who the hell is they?
Okay, so here again, we've got a great director, Robert Altman, one of my favorites of all time. So which is my favorite Altman movie? I don't know, but I know I love McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And that, too, is, of course, a Western. He, you know, systematically took apart pretty much all the Hollywood genres, and this was his genre Western turned upside down or inside out, what have you. It's another revisionist film about the end of the West. Only this time what I think is most remarkable is that it has a female character at its center, played by the glorious Julie Christie in one of her greatest roles. And she is the foil to Warren Beatty's character, the eponymous McCabe, who has come to this bedraggled Western town in the Pacific Northwest to open up a brothel. And McCabe is an unlikely hero because he's a complete bumbler. He doesn't know what he's doing. He, of course, thinks that he's the grandest guy who's ever come into this town called Presbyterian Church. And Julie Christie, who is a madam and very professional, comes in and decides, you know what? She's going to take over. And if she does, they're going to make a lot more money. Of course, it doesn't end very well. But what's really remarkable is not only that you have this iconic female character who is so breathtaking in her hard-headedness, and of course McCabe falls in love with her, but this is not a typical romance. And the way Altman just really delineates this town and the characters in it, trying to get us to see what it might have really been like to live in these places and try to forge an existence out of nothing, basically, and how these dreamers are foiled at every turn in a very unsentimental way. I think those are some of the elements that make this film great. And this clip is the first real encounter between McCabe and Mrs. Miller when she's come up to Presbyterian Church and they go to the only place in town to eat, And he proceeds to watch her devour this entire meal of eggs and stew and tea, and she's just eating like a truck driver. And then when she's finished polishing it all off, she makes her proposition.
Listen, Mr. McCabe, I'm a whore, and I know an awful lot about whorehouses. And I know that if you had a house up here, you'd stand and make yourself a lot of money. Now, this is all you've got to do. Put up the money for the house. I'll do all the rest. I'll look after the girls, the business, the expenses, the running, the furnishing, everything. And I'll pay you back any money you put in the house so you won't lose nothing. And we'll make it 50-50.
Excuse me, you know I already got a whorehouse operating.
You can't call them crib cows, whores. I'm talking about a proper sporting house with class girls and clean linen and proper hygiene.
Well, I don't think you're going to find my clientele up here too interested in that sort of thing.
They will be once they get a taste of it. I'm telling you, with someone up here to handle all them punters properly, you can make yourself at least double the money you make on your own.
What makes you think I ain't thought of that already? Them tents, you know, it's just temporary.
What do you do when one girl fancies another? How do you know when a girl really has a monthly or when she's just taking a few days off? What about when they don't get their monthlies because they don't? What do you do then? I suppose you know all about seeing to that. And what about the customers? Who's going to skin them back and inspect them? You gonna do that?
Would you?
Because if you don't, this town will be clapped up inside of 2 weeks if it's not already. What about when business is slow? You just gonna let the girls sit around on their bums? Because I'll tell you something, Mr. McCabe. When a good whore gets time to sit around and think, 4 out of 5 times you turn a religion, because that's what they was born with. And when that happens, you find yourself filling the bloody church down there instead of your own pockets. Now, I haven't got a lot of time to sit around and talk to a man who's too dumb to see a good proposition when it's put to him. Do we make a deal or don't we?
Here's another one of my favorite directors, Terrence Malick. I chose Badlands, one of his early films. He had made a couple of movies before this, but this was the one that really put him on the map. And I think it is characteristic of the best of his work in that it's a very layered, complicated film with vast panoramas, vast expanses of space within which these two characters operate. It's based kind of loosely on the young couple who went on the murder spree back in the 50s. Sissy Spacek and Martin Sheen play the couple. Sissy Spacek's character is quite young. She is the one who provides the voiceover. It's a fascinating voiceover because she's very naive and yet strangely wise. It's about their meeting, the murder of her father. He kills the father, and then they go on this long journey. And it's almost impossible to explain. You really have to see this movie to really understand it. One of my favorite passages in the film is when they're on the run, and they make this little paradise in the woods based on their notions of the Swiss Family Robinson and Robinson Crusoe. They have a kind of jungle lair in the woods, and they're preparing for the moment which inevitably comes when the law chases after them. But she's got some time to think about what's happened and ponder her life up to now. And she's looking into a stereopticon that she's taken from her home and looking at all these exotic scenes from around the world and pondering, you know, asking these really pretty deep philosophical questions in the voice of this childlike woman. And it's just absolutely magical.
One day, while taking a look at some vistas in Dad's stereopticon, it hit me that I was just this little girl, born in Texas, whose father was a sign painter, who had only just so many years to live. It sent a chill down my spine, and I thought, where would I be this very moment if Kit had never met me or killed anybody? This very moment. If my mom had never met my dad, if she'd have never died, and what's the man I'll marry going to look like? What's he doing right this minute? Is he thinking about me now by some coincidence, even though he doesn't know me? Does it show on his face? For days afterwards, I lived in dread. Sometimes I wished I could fall asleep and be taken off to some magical land. But this never happened.
Barry Lyndon, a film by Stanley Kubrick, starring Ryan O'Neal and Marissa Berenson, has won the Best Picture and Best Director Award.
I love Barry Lyndon.
Presented by the National
Board. And this I come by, honestly, I think this is one of my top two Kubrick films, the other one being Eyes Wide Shut, and which I think both of these are two of his most difficult films. Barry Lyndon, I think by people who don't know all that much about Kubrick, is probably regarded as this very lavish, beautiful costume drama, and not much more. To me, it's the film that puts the lie to the idea that Kubrick was cold and that his characters were cold-blooded. And I find this film tremendously moving. It's much more than a costume drama. It takes place in the 18th century. It's about a fairly poor Irish lad played by Ryan O'Neal, of all people. And he, by hook or by crook, runs into some bad fortune and some good fortune. It is about the fortunes of Barry Lyndon. This is based on a Thackeray novel. And he manages to marry up so that he becomes Lord Lyndon. And his stepson, Lord Bullingdon, who is played by Leon Vitali, he's terrific in this film. He's a very nasty character, hates Barry, tries to destroy him. And one of the many things I love about this film is it's about history, our place in history, and the inconquerable nature of our nature. In other words, what Barry is always trying to do is to disguise his brute nature and his origins. And yet he, along with everyone else in this highly refined society, can never quite do it. And in this scene, Lord Bullingdon interrupts this little musicale and walks in with Barry and Lady Lyndon's child, his much younger stepbrother, and basically accuses Barry of besmirching the name of the Lyndons. Barry can take it no longer and gets up and just starts pummeling him, wreaking havoc. So that you have this contrast between these very proper, still, silent, well-behaved people, these aristocrats, and the sudden breaking of this pose, which is really at the heart of much of what this film is about.
Madam! I have borne as long as mortal could endure the ill treatment of the insolent Irish upstart whom you have taken into your bed. It is not only the lowness of his birth and the general brutality of his manners which disgusts me, but the shameful nature of his conduct towards your ladyship, his brutal and ungentlemanlike behavior, his open infidelity, his shameless robberies and swindling of my property and yours. And as I cannot personally chastise this low-bred ruffian, and as I cannot bear to witness his treatment of you, and loathe his horrible society as if it were the plague, I have decided to leave my home and never return, at least during his detested life, or during my own.
Conversation is the film that is sandwiched between the two Godfather films in Francis Ford Coppola's work. And, of course, The two Godfather films are two of the greatest films ever made, and you notice they're not on my list, and it's not because they aren't two of my favorite movies. It's just because everybody knows about the Godfather films. Not as many people, I think, know about The Conversation, which it's remarkable that in between these two massive blockbusters, he makes this small, basically art film that he had been working on since the 60s. And in fact, when he made it, after the production, post-production, he handed over to the brilliant Walter Murch, the great editor and sound designer, and said, "Here, Walter, take over, because I got to go work on Godfather 2. And this is a movie that rewards many, many, many repeated viewings. It's very pertinent today because it's about surveillance, among many other things. Gene Hackman was already a star at this point, and I think this is possibly his greatest performance. He plays a very uptight, almost paranoid loner who is a surveillance expert whose job is to basically tape people covertly for big corporate clients. And he's very religious, and yet the job that he does is immoral. So you have this conflict right from the beginning. He is so afraid of revealing anything about himself that he does not tell anybody anything about who he is or what he's doing, but everybody knows he's the best in his field. He doesn't have a phone. He has no personal connections. And this is a crisis moment for him because as the film begins, he's with his surveillance crew. He's taping the conversation between a young couple, and he becomes obsessed with their conversation. He doesn't know anything about what the situation is, and he claims to not care. But as the film proceeds and he starts to clean up this conversation that he's ingeniously taped with several members of his crew all placed all around the park, he becomes obsessed with the conversation, with this couple, what's happening. He believes that they are going to be targeted for a murder. And as this proceeds, he gradually, his sense of self is also kind of stripped away, stripped down to the bare bones. And in this clip that we're going to hear, it's a great demonstration of how crucial sound is to the whole proceeding. He and his partner Stan, who's played by the great late John Cazale, are trying to clean up the tape, and he's about to reprimand him in a way that's going to make Stan leave his company. In the course of this film, he really does shed himself of any human connection as he becomes more and more aware of his complicity in these tapings. So in this section of the film, we're hearing snippets of that conversation between the young couple as we're hearing the tape being rewound, and we're hearing the conversation between Harry Call, who's played by Hackman, and Stan.
Do you think we can do this?
Tired of drinking anyhow.
What a stupid conversation.
Stan, please, I'm trying to work.
Tired of mostly everything.
Tired of me?
Tired of you. But not today.
What the hell are they talking about, for Christ's sake?
Stanley, please, I'm trying to get this done.
All right, don't get excited.
Well, I'm getting fed up.
About what?
About your asking me questions all day long.
Jesus!
Don't say that.
Well, for Christ's sakes!
Stan, don't say that again, please. Don't use that word in vain. It bothers me.
What's the matter, Harry?
Your work's getting sloppy.
Later in the week. Sunday, maybe.
Sunday, definitely.
They had a much better track here if you'd paid more attention to the recording, less attention to what they were talking about.
Well, I can't see why a couple of questions about what the hell's going on can get you so out of joint.
Because I can't sit here and explain the personal problems of my clients.
Jack Tar Hotel. 3 o'clock. Room 773.
I heard if you filled me in a little bit once in a while, did you ever think of that?
It has nothing to do with me, and even less to do with you.
It's curiosity. Did you ever hear of that? It's just goddamn human nature.
Listen, if there's one surefire rule that I have learned in this business is that I don't know anything about human nature. I don't know anything about curiosity. That's not part of what I do. This is my business. And when I'm...
The film was released in 74. It was in the middle of Watergate. I think it was 2 weeks before Nixon actually resigned. And everybody thought, wow, this is amazing. It's about surveillance and, you know, the paranoid society and everything we're going through now. But clearly it was prescient of Coppola to have picked this subject of how we live in the society where everybody can see anything and hear anything. Anybody can be revealed. Of course, today that's absolutely so relevant that the film is as fresh now as it was in 74. But it's also about this notion of identity and who are we in a society where everyone's personal life can be explored, exploited. Everybody can be watched. Everybody can be reduced to a kind of nothingness, as Harry is at the end of this film. Killer of Sheep is just such a remarkable film that I love to tell people about it, made by one of the greatest filmmakers you've never heard of, Charles Burnett, an African-American filmmaker who started out in the 70s, grew up in the neighborhood of Watts in L.A., went to UCLA and became part of a very influential but relatively little-known group of young black filmmakers, variously known as the L.A. Movement or the Black Independent Movement. They were really trying to present a kind of counter to blaxploitation in exploring the real lives of the people that they knew, the people that they grew up with, working class and middle class African Americans, poor people, people from Watts. And this is a film about a man who has a wife and two children, and he has a home, but he's just barely making it. The title comes from the fact that he works in a slaughterhouse. And so you have these scenes of him working in the slaughterhouse. So that is kind of the backdrop. And he's going through this period of despair. This, too, is a very unconventional narrative. It really is a series of vignettes about Stan and his surroundings and his life and his friends as they try to negotiate their way through this fairly grim landscape. And what's, you know, there are so many remarkable things about this film. There's not a whole lot of dialogue. There are only two professional actors, and the rest are basically mostly neighborhood people, so not professional actors. He made the film for under $10,000, and it took him quite a long time. Then it got released in 77 and made a splash in Europe. I think it was at the Berlin Film Festival and also at Toronto, but it could not be released because he couldn't buy the music rights. They were too expensive. This is a movie that is peppered with the music of African-American history, from Paul Robeson to spirituals to Earth, Wind, and Fire. So there's a lot of music in this film, very meaningful, but it also prevented the film from getting a public viewing, basically, until Steven Soderbergh in 2007 helped to pay for the music rights, and then it was restored and released. And since then, it really has become a landmark film. And I would say it's an extremely influential film for young Black filmmakers who are coming up now or who grew up having seen or heard about this film. It's very quiet, beautifully composed. Every single shot in this film really tells the story. And between music and image, we understand what's going on. But if you're looking for a plot, you're not going to find it. It's just about Stan's life and the world that he lives in. It's so beautiful and it's so remarkable, and there's nothing else like it. So this is a moment when Stan and his friend go to the apartment of some other friends because they want to buy a motor for Stan's car. And it's just basically a bunch of people sitting around talking. There's, you know, a lot of aggressive chit-chat. Much of it is, I believe, improvised by people who are not actors. And in this scene, the woman who's kind of being prodded on by another guy in the scene actually ends up kicking him in the head. And Stan is very upset about this, but the guy's uncle is more concerned about his hair. They end up getting the motor for $15.
You know, you would be a good-looking fella if you didn't frown so much.
Some sister told me I look just like Clark Gable.
You about as tasteless as a carrot.
You always an old nasty frame of mind.
Just a regular hardship case. Someone always trying to revive your poor ass or give you first aid. Always feeling sorry for yourself.
If I don't, nobody else will. You just an all-day sucker, bitch. Be done, no, no, be done!
Sim, she kicked your nephew over here, man. See, man, come over here, man, to sit by him.
I've got more important things to do. My hair's falling out.
Say, man, he's bleeding.
Why'd you have to kick the son of a bitch in his damn head? Silver, you better come over here and see about your nephew.
Can't you see I don't give a damn? He shouldn't have run his damn mouth so much. Give me $15 for the motor and his shirt for collateral, and it'd be slick.
And then after this happens, you see there's this long scene of Stan and his friend trying to get this huge motor down this long, precipitous staircase. And they put it in the back of their pickup truck. And they don't shove it in far enough. And his friend says, oh, it'll be fine. So of course, they start the truck, drive off, and the motor lands on the street and is ruined. Okay, so Margaret is Kenneth Lonergan's second film. It's a kind of a love or hate movie. A lot of people don't know about it. And it, too, is very unconventional. But I think it highlights Lonergan's strengths as a screenwriter and a playwright. And I find the movie absolutely fascinating and really brilliant in its ability to reveal how difficult it is for people to communicate with each other. And the dialogue and the scenes are just so true to the way things are. Lisa Cohen is a 17-year-old girl, kind of spoiled, self-involved, not particularly likable, a little strident, really likes to have her own way. And very early on in the film, she distracts a bus driver, played by Mark Ruffalo. He runs a red light and runs over Allison Janney, who plays Monica. It's a cameo role. As she is there dying in the street, and Lisa runs up to her and is cradling her in her arms as she's dying. And the rest of the film is really about Lisa coming to grips with this horrific encounter with death, which is so much of what Lonergan's work is about, your encounter in your everyday life with the abyss. Something unfathomable happens and you have to go on living with it. Manchester by the Sea is obviously all about that as well. But in this case, the protagonist is a girl who is so self-dramatizing, which is kind of the point. And she encounters Monica's close friend, played by an incredible Jeannie Berlin, a great character actress, and kind of gets what's coming to her in terms of being told that she is not the center of the universe. Narratively, it's kind of all over the place, but scene by scene, you can't take your eyes off it. So this is the pivotal scene. You know, this crowd gathers. Two of the guys who just happen to be walking by are trying to save her life. They're trying to put a tourniquet, and she is dying, and she doesn't know what's happening. So Lisa is there trying to comfort her. She's practically hysterical for good reason. And once Monica dies, she really can't come to grips with it. She keeps trying to, you know, revive her. She can't accept it. Monica says, get in touch with my daughter. It turns out that the daughter had died some time ago. So she's approaching death. I mean, it's just, it's a remarkable scene.
Step back. I'm calling one right now.
Can you hear me?
Someone's calling.
Ma'am, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I don't know. Where am I?
Broadway and 75th.
Broadway between 75th and 74th Street.
Who are you?
My name is Lisa.
What do you mean?
Am I dead?
No, you're not dead. You're in a traffic accident, but you're going to be okay.
I don't have a direct address. She's out in the street.
What do you mean? What happened?
You were run over by a bus.
You got to be kidding me. A bus?
Yeah.
Is there a doctor?
Am I now?
An ambulance is on its
still
way.
Still happening?
No, I mean, yes, the accident's over.
Are my eyes open or closed?
They're open.
What do you mean?
Hold on a second. Yeah, you're okay.
Somebody.
You're gonna be okay.
Could somebody call my daughter?
Sure, we can call her. Oh, what's her name? Just tell me your name and give me your number.
It's Lisa.
No, that's my name. Is that your daughter's name?
What? What are you talking about?
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be confusing. My name is Lisa. Is that your daughter's name?
Oh, Jesus Christ, just call her. Would you call her?
I can't call her if you don't give me the number.
This is a film that is, I believe, well worth your patience. Yes, it's quite long, but one of the things that draws me to it, you know, it's a post-9/11 film, is this sense of our relationship to history, even as we don't really realize it, the time we live in and the larger events that surround us and the impact that they have on the way we define ourselves and our relationships to others is very important in this movie, as is this constant inability to speak the truth or to speak our truest feelings to each other. And what's remarkable to me about Lonergan's work is that there isn't one single line of dialogue that he writes that does not refer to that central problem. And yet, every single line of dialogue he writes sounds absolutely authentic. And it's just a remarkable piece of work.
Linda DeLibro is Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University. You can hear part one of A Film Critic's Favorite Films by going to episode 421 and hearing our other critic, Chris Reed, talk about some of his top choices. I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun. For producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.